Raising the Bets is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to Raising the Bets, a family podcast of pirates and penguins. We're a Catholic couple raising five kids outside of Boston. Join us as we share the joys and challenges of marriage, homeschool, and our adventures near and far as we make sense of the world and experience the best parts of our culture. I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
So this week, it was an interesting week. We didn't actually go any place particularly interesting, but
no, we didn't.
We had excitement close. We had a Bomba Genesis. Again, I think I mentioned that was coming, right? I think that we mentioned that last time.
I don't remember that.
Or I mentioned it to somebody, but Bomba Genesis is it's a fun word. It's one of these new weather words that the weathermen have come up with. It basically means like a really bad windy storm that's not a cyclone. It's not like a spinny storm. Like it's not a hurricane. It's not a tornado. Blizzard.
I wonder about these words. Like, are they really new words that like meteorologists used amongst themselves, but they just didn't use to the general public? Or are they like...
Or did someone make it up like a la marketing for the Weather Channel?
Right. I always wonder, what's the provenance?
Yeah, or it's also sometimes called explosive cyclogenesis, which frankly is an even better word. It's a popular term used by meteorologists. That sounds like it's not a scientific, like, meteorological science term. Easy for me to say, but something else. Anyway, we had one of those.
Uh-huh.
Which meant it was rainy and really windy early this week. So like Tuesday night into Wednesday. Although I've begun measuring the wind by whether it lifts up the it's not a gazebo, the sun shade. We call it the gazebo on the patio, the sun cover. If it lifts it up and moves it, that's a really windy storm.
I don't think I heard it moving.
It didn't. Because if it moves it, I see it's off the patio usually. So it was windy, but not that windy. Anyway,
it was enough windy to knock out our power on Wednesday morning.
Yeah, Wednesday morning we had a couple of blinks. In fact, the blink woke us up because the power blinked in all of the automatic lights. When the automatic lights have a power outage and come back on, they're set to automatically go on.
To bright.
To on full power.
Yeah, so this is maybe a problem.
Well, there's a decision to be made when you do that, when you set it up. You could have it so that when the power cycles, it stays off. But what that means is if someone comes along and flips the switch, in order to turn it back on, you have to go into the app or tell Echo or Siri to turn it on.
You can't just...
Well, because flipping the switch won't turn it back on, right? Restoring power won't just turn it back on. So which is more likely to happen? A power outage in the middle of the night?
But which is more annoying? To have all the lights in the house go on at 2:00 in the morning? Or
have a light that you need to go into an app to turn back on?
But actually, they're both really annoying.
What they need to do is set it up so that if all of the lights go off at once, it's smart enough to know that when the power comes back, they should not just come back. They should go back to the state they were before.
Or maybe have it smart enough to know that you don't want the lights to come on in the middle of your sleep cycle. And so it should have this is my sleep cycle timer.
How does it know that you're asleep?
No. But like between, 10 p.m. and 1,
it was 6:00 in the morning.
Yeah, that's too early.
For some people, that is not the middle of their sleep cycle. Because I just got up for the day because I'm usually my alarm is set for 6:30. If it wakes me up at 6, I'm up. So
yeah, if something wakes me up at 6, I'm definitely not up.
So it cycled. It did that. Then it did it again a little while later. And then at 8, boom, it was out, which meant I was out of business for the day. Which is annoying because I didn't have any recordings, but I had stuff to edit. Which I always have stuff to do. And I had to get ready for a big recording that night, which made me worried. And then the first problem was I had not yet made coffee. I know that's my mistake.
I had not yet made tea.
It was 8:00. I hadn't made coffee. I should have made coffee as soon as I got up, as soon as the power cycled. My bad. And yes, you had not made tea. And so my problem is I was out of beans. So I used to get Mystic Monk beans, which if I had beans, I could take the electric grinder to the car and grind them, you know, in the socket that goes in the,
you know,
car.
Some people keep like instant coffee on hand for these kinds of emergencies.
Well, instant coffee. Oh, like
some people who aren't coffee snobs. Evidently.
That would be worse than what I ended up doing. So I got out the camp stove and set it up on the patio. By this time, most of the storm had passed. And so I set up on the patio and I started boiling water for your tea. So I figured I could at least get you your tea. But what am I going to do? So because I usually, if I don't have beans, I have a Keurig and I'll make K-cups. But I can't make K-cups. You know, I'm not going to drag the Keurig out to the car. That's not going to happen. Although if I got desperate enough. So I dug around in the drawer where we keep the coffee and I found an old bag of pre-ground Mystic Monk hazelnut coffee. I think your mom bought
that. Sounds like
it.
Something my mom would have.
I don't. I am not a flavored coffee fan myself, and I usually just buy beans, not pre-ground. I may keep a sealed bag of pre-ground coffee around after this. So I hauled that out there. I got no idea how old it was. It tasted ancient. It was. I put it in my AeroPress and made it that way. It was at least coffee. I had plenty of milk. I even added sugar to it. I never put sugar in my coffee, and I even added sugar to it just to make it drinkable. And the thing that was that really made me mad was my shipment of new beans was due that day. Later that day, that my beans were on a truck at that moment, heading toward me.
Mm-hmm.
So the other problem was Wednesday was going to be shopping day.
Yes.
So. And there was no point in going to the store and buying a bunch of food because there was power in the town where our grocery store is because they're on their own independent grid. We should move to that town. They apparently don't lose power like we do. But there's no point in buying all that food and bringing it back and having no place to put it because there's no power to the fridge or freezer.
Right.
So the problem with that is there wasn't really food for lunch.
And then the problem also was that the next day was not a day that was as convenient to go grocery shopping.
Right, right. There was appointments and other stuff like that and classes and things. So what do we do? Like there was food we could have cooked, like in a microwave, you know, that sort of thing. I suppose I could have thrown some hot dogs on the grill, like on the camp stove.
We didn't have any hot dog buns.
Oh, that was, yeah. Big problem. The kids were
we were out of bread at that point.
Right. There was no bread to make sandwiches.
Yeah.
No, we couldn't bake any. I'm just going to build that backyard brick oven one of these days so we can bake our own bread in the backyard.
That would not have been an option. That would not have been for lunch.
No. So we ended up deciding to go to McDonald's again in the next town that had power, which, you know, these days going anywhere, especially all seven of us, is just. It's an obstacle in the best of times, in the times when we can't actually go into the places. But the thing is, McDonald's has that app now. So we drove up, I parked, I put in our order one at a time. This is all we want. Seven different orders. Everybody's going to have something. No pickles, no mushrooms. They don't have mushrooms at McDonald's. No, whatever this. We had
mayonnaise,
to change it.
Mayonnaise, mustard.
Yes.
Onions.
Yes. So we had to, every order was a special order. So you know what that means.
They got them all wrong.
So, yeah. So you order it, then you say, I'm here. So you could order from home. I could, but I didn't have, we are in a dead zone when it comes to AT&T, which is our phone service. So without the internet, it was really hard to get an internet connection on my phone. So we ordered from their parking lot. I'm here. Bring it out to the car. Which they did. So that part worked okay.
Yeah, they just got the orders wrong.
They just got the order wrong. I mean, it was mostly right, but, you know, like Bella's sandwich had pickles that she didn't want or something.
Everything. It had everything that she didn't want.
Oh, it did? I didn't realize that.
Yeah. It had mustard and it had pickles and it had onions and she was not very happy.
Yeah.
But there were at least two of them each, so they got extra burgers.
Right. And you had, what'd you want? A quarter pounder?
Yes.
No cheese. They didn't. So it was a quarter pounder. No cheese. And you got, tomato, right? No, you didn't get the tomato.
They didn't put lettuce and tomato on
it. Even though I paid for the tomato. It's just, ugh, McDonald's. Come on.
Yeah, there's a reason my dad never, ever took us to McDonald's when we were on the road when we were kids, because McDonald's always screwed up our orders and Burger King never did. So
any more than
we were a yeah. Burger King family.
If it's any more than a handful of different orders, if there are any special changes, it's going to be wrong. It's just wrong. I mean, we like that time when we went last year or I forget where it was. It's in the before time when we went to that. We were going to the nature place.
Yeah.
Last fall, I think it was. And they that one McDonald's really they gave us somebody else's order. Like it was really messed up.
Oh, yeah.
It was really bad. It was a different McDonald's. But so
I'm just yeah, I feel like they're OK if you just want to order right off the menu. But if you have any preferences.
Right. Or if there's two of us or if we're just getting like it used to be four Happy Meals. Just give me four Happy Meals. That worked. Give me four hamburger Happy Meals. Boom. Eat two hamburger Happy Meals and two chicken McNugget Happy Meals. Here you go. Like that worked. But now they're all older and they all have like, oh, I want this. I want that. And I got to have a special order, this and that. And then it becomes much more complicated. And our kids have become very picky about eating.
Have become? No, they're less picky than they used to be.
No, well, like, I can't eat a hot dog today because we don't have whole wheat hot dog buns. We have hot dog buns, but they're not whole wheat.
But yeah, but this is the child who wouldn't used to eat hot dogs at all, so this is an improvement.
I know. And other people's kids are the same way. I mean, at least our kids will eat, like, hamburgers. You know, there are people whose kids will not eat, like, anything but a McNugget or something. Anyway. So, the power outage. We got power back around 3:30, something like 3:30. And you ended up going to the grocery store when? Thursday?
Yes.
After Thursday afternoon after Bella's classes. So that Bella could push the cart for you.
Yeah.
And it just screwed up my whole week, too, with the work. Like, I was scrambling on Friday to get everything
done. Threw us off for the whole week. It was annoying.
Yes, very annoying.
I mean, we did manage to get most of the kids got most of their schoolwork done on Wednesday, which was good.
Yep.
The things that required the internet. Yeah. Or
Bella couldn't do her math. The Khan Academy.
Right.
Right. Yeah. It was at least it wasn't Thursday when she has her online classes.
That would have been bad.
I mean, I was thinking about all the kids in Holbrook who couldn't do their or all the other surrounding towns who couldn't do their remote learning because in Holbrook Wednesday. So our public schools are doing a hybrid system. Half the kids are in the school on Monday and Tuesday and at home on Thursday, Friday. Half are in the school on Thursday, Friday and at home on Monday, Tuesday. And they're all at home on Wednesday. Wednesday was the day.
Right. That was the worst day.
The worst possible day. Yes.
Power outage.
Although if they were at school, they still would have not had power. I don't know. No smart boards. I don't know. I don't know what they do at public school now. But yeah, they could do something, I guess. Still do some teaching. Anyway, apart from the power outage, power's back. Lesson learned. Really, really want to figure out a way to get a solar power battery back up. Which is not cheap, I know. So, got to figure out because we lose power way too much here to just kind of, and it drives me crazy that we have solar panels on the roof that we can't use because we don't have a battery backup, which means we're not on the grid. It's a whole thing.
It's ridiculous that we have solar panels and yet we're losing power when the power goes out.
The whole thing is you have to have an interconnect cutoff so that when power goes out. The panels are not shoving electricity into the grid for the linemen who are trying to fix it, get electrocuted. That's the big thing. So you have to have an interconnect shut off and that only gets installed with batteries or something. That was the explanation I was given. So it could be wrong, but we'll see. Anyway, Scouts, Ben had his first Boy Scout meeting. So he has been, we mentioned before, he was a Cub Scout. And he was moving up. He wasn't able to complete Weeblos for, you know, various reasons last spring. And so, but now he's old enough now that he is ready to do Boy Scouts and he was raring to go. So we went to our first Boy Scout troop meeting here in town, the Troop 56, where it has a lot of the same adult leaders. So Dan and Adam are there, which is great. And he did so good. Like, he was raring to go. There was no, you know, okay, let's go. You know, you really wanted to do this, remember? No, there was none of that. He was like, yes, okay, let's go. I'm ready to go. Boom. He was excited. His uniform was coming, which unfortunately was delayed a day. So he ended up getting it on Tuesday, but he was very excited. His new uniform. And, but we went to the meeting and he was right in. Boom. He was talking with them. I didn't need to be there. In fact, tomorrow I'm going to drop him off and come home and then come back for him. Because he did not need me at all.
That's awesome.
It was great. I'm really excited. And the boys there were really nice. They're welcoming. They really integrated him into the troop right away. They were teaching him stuff. They're planning their first camping trip and all this other stuff. So that'd be great.
Very cool.
And then the girls BSA scout meeting. So this is how it's come out. Remember the whole, what do we call them?
Uh-huh.
It's Boy Scouts and BSA Scouts. I've seen the official Boy Scout magazine referred to them that way now.
BSA Scouts.
Boy Scouts and BSA Scouts.
So BSA means the
Girl Scouts.
Girl Scouts.
But not the Girl Scouts. That's not the Girl Scouts of America.
Because that's GSA.
Yes. So it's Girl Scouts of BSA. So BSA Scouts means girls. So their troop met inside for the first time. So they had an outside meeting a few weeks ago. They met inside. And one of the girls couldn't be there because her family was exposed to someone with COVID. So they were potentially, infected. They had to be quarantined until the test came back. So they brought her in via FaceTime, which was fun. And so they had a teddy bear that they put the phone in its arms. And she was the teddy bear for the thing. So she led the opening ceremony with the flag and the Pledge of Allegiance and everything. It was really cute. It was really funny. So they had a good time.
Interesting times.
Yeah. The nice thing is when they do the camping trip, the BSA Scouts and the Boy Scouts will be there, and the Weeblos will all be there, which Anthony's a Weeblo now. So they all can go, and Lucy can go, I guess, because she's a sibling. And she, when I first kind of said that she might not go, she crumpled.
She got really sad looking.
She got really sad, and you cannot deny the sad Lucy anything. So but she can go because the siblings, especially when it's multiple siblings who are going, they can go. They're really fine with that, and then they can all stay in the same tent. So that's what we've been doing. Anything else?
We had
a little bit of a campfire yesterday.
Yeah, that was fun
for the thing I'm going to talk about in a minute. But it was kind of interesting. So we needed a fire to make a recipe as we were cooking something in the Dutch oven. And Ben and Anthony really they asked if they could keep the fire going and could eat their dinner outside. We had chili. So they could eat their dinner outside around it. And so the kids all ate their dinner outside around the fire. I thought it was great. And they took care of it. They made sure someone was always watching it. They had the water bucket there. They were feeding it properly.
Yep. Ben said, I'm in charge of the fire because I'm the Boy Scout here.
That's right. So it was awesome. So, yes, I was mentioning for what we're cooking. So Bella knows that she learned at her meeting. Back up. Start again. She learned at her scout meeting that one of the activities on the camping trip will be a cooking competition, an Iron Chef cooking.
Oh, I didn't actually hear about that.
Yes. So they'll be given I'm not sure whether they're going to be given ingredients and told to cook something or whether they'll be asked to make something and then there'll be a judging. I forget. I wasn't in on it, that part of it. But she decided that they want to make a... she wanted to try a few different things. She wanted to get some experience cooking in the Dutch oven, which we have, we hadn't used before. So we had seen this video from Scouter Carl on YouTube showing how to make a Dutch oven apple cake. And so it was pretty simple. It's basically a white cake box recipe. You put it in the Dutch oven. You preheat the Dutch oven. You put it in the Dutch oven. You take some apples that you've cored and peeled and sliced. Coat them in cinnamon sugar, and then you just kind of stick it in the batter and then put some cinnamon sugar on top. And then you put the Dutch oven with some coals underneath and some coals on top, and it bakes in there for 40 minutes. It's really simple. And that's what she did. And she did great. it was a little overdone on the bottom.
Yeah.
Not burned. Like, it wasn't charcoal-y, but it was definitely...
It was kind of black.
It was kind of black, but it was still soft. It was still not hard, right?
Right. So it was right on that edge.
It was any longer, it would have burned. So that was, I mean, it's hard to figure out how many coals do we need. So I definitely didn't need as many coals underneath as we had. And I think our Dutch oven is bigger than his, so it made it thinner, which might have made it cook a little faster. I think that might have been part of it, too. But it came out. It was good. I mean, it's box cake. We haven't had a box cake in this house before.
Not since the kids were really little.
You make cakes from scratch. It was, I mean, let's be honest. Cake out of a box is like a sponge. It was, the texture is kind of springy.
I would have cut the apples up smaller or maybe added some applesauce to the batter.
Yes.
To make it a little bit more apple-y. Because it was kind of like cake with like big chunks of apple in it.
Most definitely. I think for the first try that like I like to follow the recipe for the first try. But yeah, in the future, I might even get some apple juice or apple cider and substitute some of the water in the cake for apple cider.
Mm, yeah, that could work.
Like maybe half and half or like a half of the water or even a third of the water for juice. Just to get some more apple flavor in it, definitely.
And more cinnamon, I think. I would add some cinnamon sugar, maybe just cinnamon, to the batter, too, to make it kind of more cinnamony.
Yeah, I was trying to get, we were out of cinnamon sugar, and I had mixed it up right then and there, so that it really hadn't had time to blend in. So I don't think that the sugar I was putting on it was all that. And I think the things are clogged, the shaker.
You can mix cinnamon sugar just in a bowl.
I know. I was trying to refill it. It was being quick. Anyway, good first effort and great effort from Bella. I was really excited for her. She was really happy with that.
Yeah, she's really excited about camp cooking.
Yeah, we're going to do some more cooking in the Dutch oven, so that'll be fun. I might have to get a tripod for it, though. I think our next goal might be bread, because there's another YouTube camping guy called Simon, a bloke in the woods. He's a guy in Britain and who does a lot of camp cooking stuff. So I've watched a few of his videos. It was pretty cool. I like his videos. The other thing I made on Friday was a dish called spiced shrimp in tomatoes and mint. And this was a Milk Street Kitchen recipe. Its original name is Zibdiet Gambari. It's a Gazan shrimp dish. So like the Gaza Strip, the Holy Land.
Okay.
It's traditionally made, as they say, in an oven in a zibdia or a clay bowl. But this one is in a skillet. We didn't have you bought the frozen cooked shrimp. Their recipe has you start with,
of course,
raw shrimp. But it worked out okay.
Shrimp is a little.
It didn't brown the shrimp. The shrimp is supposed to brown.
Yeah.
So what you do is you mix the shrimp with there's a spice mixture of ground coriander, ground cumin, and allspice. And then you mix the shrimp with some of that. And then you brown the shrimp. But because the shrimp was frozen and defrosted, it kind of gave off a lot of liquid. So it more braised than anything. It didn't really brown, which is fine. It was still good. Then you cook. So once that's done, you add tomatoes, like cherry tomatoes. So a lot of, it was like 2 pints of cherry tomatoes, 4 cups, which is, it's a lot of cherry tomatoes. We had plenty. And you put those in the oven, in the skillet, and cover it and cook. And a few of them will start to burst, but not many. You don't have to worry because you'll eventually burst them all. Then you add onion, garlic, a slice of jalapeno. I used a whole slice of jalapeno. There was too much. The problem is jalapenos, you never know how hot they're going to be. But it was too much. I would have used half as much jalapeno as I used in that. But I mean, I liked it. But for the kid, for everyone else, was a jar of the roasted red peppers. You pat it dry and chop it up, and you put that in the pan after you've taken the shrimp out, and then you put the rest of the spice mixture in, and then you cook it, and then you add water, and you cook it some more until the water evaporates. And then you smash the cherries down so that you burst them all.
The cherry tomatoes.
Sorry. You smash the cherry tomatoes until they all burst. And that's what makes the sauce. And it's a, it becomes, it's kind of a chunky, thick sauce. It was pretty good. And then you you add the shrimp back in, and you add in mint, like a half a cup of chopped fresh mint. And it was really good. We served it over rice, but you could have it with the, we also had naan, if you wanted naan, too. And that was good. So like pita bread or anything like that would have worked really well. What did you think?
I liked it.
Yeah. Some of the kids liked it. Sophie liked it. Anthony ate a jalapeno and then spent the rest of the dinner.
Oh, poor thing. He was gasping. He was in pain.
He was drinking all the milk, trying to make it stop burning.
But he wanted to keep eating.
He liked it.
He did try to keep eating.
Yeah.
It was just, he was in pain.
Poor guy. But that, I liked it. I'd try it again, and I'll just make some differences, some changes to it, to the recipe, you know, the next time.
Yeah.
But I'll make it a little less spicy, I think would be good. So that's what we've been eating. Mary, I think Mary Renda was asking for the recipe. So I will put the link to the recipe in the show notes, Mary. So I told her to listen to the podcast. We'd talk about it. All right. So reading and watching. So I think I watched only one new thing this week. I watched the first episode of a new Apple TV Plus series called Tehran. And it's about an Israeli Mossad agent who is undercover in Tehran trying to break into, I think, an air defense system. Like, she's a hacker spy to knock down the air defense system because they want to bomb a nuclear plant that's making weaponized plutonium or something. I forget what exactly it was. It felt like an episode of Homeland or one of these other, you know, spy shows. A lot of local language speaking, so a lot of
subtitles.
A lot of subtitles. So there's a lot of Farsi and a lot of Hebrew and a lot of subtitles. So it's one of those ones you have to kind of pay attention and watch as, uh-huh, as they go, or you're going to miss out on things. But I liked it pretty good. It was okay. But there needs to be more. There wasn't a whole lot of character development. There's a lot of like tension and drama. But there's also the one actor who plays the lead Iranian anti-spy guy, the counterintelligence agent. I've seen him in a few things, and he's really good. I really like him, so I'm looking forward to seeing. So I'm hoping to watch some more of that. I don't know when I will get a chance to. It's not like super high on my list of things to watch, but it was okay.
I don't think I watched anything this week.
Yeah,
I'm trying to remember. It's a blur.
Well, as far as reading, so there's something we both read together, but we'll get to that last because we'll talk about that. But I finished another Dresden Files novel called The Turncoat. It was good. Some big character moments in that.
And I finished the new Dresden Files, which came out this last week, Battleground.
Battleground. So he had two of them come out this year.
Right. Basically, he wrote a novel that was way too big, and so he chopped it into two and released one in August and one in
September.
No, one in July and one in September,
yeah,
like 2 months apart. It felt like it. I mean, Peace Talks felt like the first
book.
Half of a book.
Yeah.
I mean, he tried to give it a kind of its own arc, but it was the first half of a book.
Okay.
And this was Battleground is the second half. I mean, Battleground, most of the novel was the big battle scene. I mean, broken up with like character bits in between.
Yeah.
But it was pretty much the battle scene, the great big finale battle scene that you've been building to over several books.
Don't say anything. Don't spoil it. I'm still five books behind you.
No, but at the same time, there's more series to go. So this is not by any stretch of the imagination the end.
There's more story.
There's lots more story.
Right.
Lots more characters, lots more stuff. I mean, basically, it ends with like, okay, I need the next book because I have got to figure out what's going on with this stuff.
Right.
So it's big, but it's not the end.
Okay. So I'm on the 12th book. And so Peace Talks is the 16th book.
And Battleground was the 17th.
Yeah. So I'm guessing I'm going to catch up probably in a month or two, because I've got other books I want to read. Like, it takes me about a week to read a Dresden novel, and I've got a some other new books that are coming out that are on my list that I want to read as they come out. But interesting. And then, of course, there's also a couple of short stories.
Yeah, there's a couple of short story collections.
Yeah, we've mentioned those before. Yeah. But okay, good. I mean, the series gets better as you go on. It really does.
Oh, yeah.
Someone was saying online today, like, I keep hearing about Dresden, you know, I'm not really much of a fiction reader, but, you know, convince me. And I think it was Will Duquette was saying, if you're not really much of a fiction reader, I'm not sure this is for you. Like,
right.
Like it, just because everybody's talking about it, if fiction is not your thing, it doesn't necessarily mean that this is your thing to do.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I love it, but.
Right. If you don't like urban fantasy, like fantasy, wizards, magic, this isn't going to be your bag of tea.
Right.
Or whatever.
Bag of tea.
Bag of tea.
Something.
Did I say that? I don't know.
It's like your bag of wizards.
So yeah, this week I read Battleground. I also finished a juvenile novel called Tug of War, which I really liked. I ended up finding it because somebody recommended a different novel by the author, and which was not available at the library, but, you know, I was like, well, what else has she written? And it's called Tug of War by Joan Lindgaard, I think. I always want to say Lindgren, but I think it's Lindgaard. Anyway, it follows a Latvian family who are refugees during World War II. And I'm feeling like I've explained this before, but maybe I was not on the show. I'm getting some deja vu here. I really liked it. I didn't know much about Latvia, I gotta say. And so that was interesting. The protagonists are twins, Astra and Hugo, who are 14 years old at the beginning of the novel. They get separated when they get to Germany. And Hugo accidentally loses his glasses and is like almost blind without them. And he gets separated from his family, gets on the wrong train, and they spend the rest of the war separated, going through separate adventures.
This does sound familiar, but maybe you were just telling it
to me. I think I just was telling it to you. I don't think I was telling it to the rest of the world.
Okay.
And the tug of war ends up being like, well, they leave these different lives and they don't get together. I don't want to spoil it, but they don't get back together again until after the war is over. And they've kind of started to put down roots and live separate lives. And so there's the tug of war is both external, like the war has tugged them apart. But then there's also this internal like struggle about like, you know, how do you like get tugged between your family and then all the other people that you've met along the way? And yeah, it was good. It was a great experience of World War II from a slightly different perspective. I've seen, you know, people in prisoner of war camps, people in concentration camps, soldiers fighting on both sides, spies, etc. This was really the first, I think, refugees being shuttled around in Germany during wartime. And so there was a very different sort of approach. I mean, at sometimes when they're in prisoner of war, refugee resettlement camps, they kind of feel like concentration camps and they're being run by the Germans, probably the same people who are running the concentration camps. And it's very dehumanizing and unpleasant, but they're not prisoners. So there's a difference.
So this Goodreads lists it as Peterson Family number one.
Which is interesting because I would love to read Peterson Family number two if it exists.
Yeah. Although I'm looking at it, I don't see anything obviously.
Right.
Yeah. So.
Anyway, the book that was recommended to me was by a blog reader of mine who recommended a novel called Clearances, which evidently was the first in like, I think, a four novel arc about people in Scotland. And it looked really, really good, but I went to the library, didn't have any copies, and I didn't find anything online that was like less than $15. And I was like, do I really want to spend $15 on a completely unknown quantity based on, I'm sure my reader, you know, recommended the book and really liked it, but is that enough to you know, spend $15 on? So I thought I'd read another book by the novelist, and at this point I'm thinking maybe I will take a chance on The Clearance. That's what it was.
Yeah, it's listed as Maggie number one, like the series is called Maggie,
right?
So take that for so The Clearance, The Resettling, The Pilgrimage, and The Reunion.
Yes, and it looks like at some point they put a really, really cheesy 80s cover on it.
Oh, cheesy, like 80s romance novel. Well, there's not a guy on it, so. Oh my gosh, that's like, oh, what is her name? From, oh, Valerie Bertinelli was in it. Her sister in that series.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Oh my gosh, it's like a very 70s series. And it was like the cover picture is of her, of the actress who played her sister. Oh my.
Right. And maybe it was made into a TV show at some point.
Maybe.
Who knows?
Anyway, very 80s.
So well, that's on my list of things to look up eventually and maybe try to find.
And then what we both read, we kind of previewed this last week because we were talking about how the book was coming out this week. We both started and finished in a week. This book, A Deadly Education by Naomi Novik. And if you listened last week, you heard us talking about Naomi Novik and how much we enjoyed her other books. So this is it's listed as the first of a 2-book duology. And
although I could see this going a lot further than 2 books.
I could see it too. If she wanted to continue the interest. So it's a wizarding school where the protagonists have to fight back against evil things to make it to graduation. It feels very much like a take on, of course, the Potterverse, but taking the Potterverse at its face value. And what I mean is, like, the whole Harry Potter phenomenon in Hogwarts is kind of horrific when you think about it, because, I mean, kids die. Like, this is real power being thrown around. There are real awful monsters that they encounter and have to deal with. And there are Dementors, which are technically the good guys.
Right. At the same time, Harry Potter kind of feels like it's not really fish nor fowl. It doesn't really lean into the horror. A Deadly Education leans in.
Yeah.
It doesn't pull any punches. There's no happy, beautiful feasts, funny ghosts, or there's nothing really fun or funny about it.
It is a horrific survival of the fittest magic school where
dog
have a 1 in 4 chance of surviving to graduation.
Right. It's a very dog eat dog, might makes right. And it sounds...
The system is very Darwinian to weed out the weak.
It sounds like horrific, and like, why would I read this? And yet, and the protagonist is not really...
She's not really likable.
Likeable.
Yeah.
But...
At first.
She gets better. She grows on you. At least she grew on me.
And it's a first-person narrative, so there's a bit of an unreliable narrator going on here.
Right. I really found it compelling. I wanted more. And in fact, I got to the end of the book and I flipped immediately back to the beginning of the book and started reading it again. This is not something I do. I do not go back and reread books right after I finish them. But I really wanted to keep living in the universe, and I wanted to like fill in the details of things that I'd read too quickly at first and hadn't really remembered or caught. It's like there's a puzzle going on.
Naomi Novik has quickly become a fantastic writer. I mean, she like we said this before, she was good before. She has quickly become one of my favorite writers. And it's a closed box universe. Like, it all takes place within this very closed, literally closed universe of a school.
Right.
And
it's like the characters are locked in until they graduate.
Yes.
You cannot leave.
Right. It's except by
welcome to the Hotel California.
Yeah.
You can check in, but you can never leave.
And it takes place in our world.
I liked that too. Like, one of the things that kind of bothers me about Harry Potter is that the Muggle world and the wizarding world sort of intermesh, and yet the wizards don't really know anything about the Muggle world. They're all bizarrely ignorant of technology and Muggle culture. Whereas in this one, The worlds are intermeshed. The mundanes don't know anything about the wizarding world.
In fact, magic doesn't work around mundanes.
Right. But the wizards are living in our world until they go to the magic school. They know about...
They watch Star Wars.
Star Wars and Lord of the Rings. And they, you know, movies and video games and all
the
of
main
the
characters named Galadriel. Her mother named her after Galadriel.
Right. All of the stuff about our world. And so I liked that better than the.
So reading the acknowledgments, the author, Novik, credits her. She acknowledges one of the editors for really defining for her that her audience is now in their 30s, which she has a hard time believing. And what she's referring to there is this is who she was writing for. She's writing for the Harry Potter generation, who are now in their 30s, who now want that story, but written for them as they are now adults in their 30s, as opposed to tweens.
I'm really curious. Is this going to appeal to people who grew up with Harry Potter? I did not grow up with Harry Potter. I encountered Harry Potter.
Harry Potter was, I was practically a parent by that point.
Years after I graduated from college, like I think the year I started grad school, which was not immediately after college. So for me, Harry Potter was very much a adult experience as opposed to a formative youth experience.
I connected with it through my oldest niece, Mary. She was a huge fan of Harry Potter. That's how I first encountered Harry Potter. So, yeah, it was I was very much as an adult, and I wasn't part of that generation.
Right.
So I
have no idea if this will appeal or, or not.
You and I agreed on Harry Potter. Like, I enjoy Harry Potter for what it is, but I don't think it's great. I don't think it's fantastic. It has many flaws.
And we, of course, hit it at that time where we were a lot more distant and skeptical and kind of able to hold it at arm's length because I wasn't reading it when I was, 8, 9, 10, 12, whatever, it wasn't part of my childhood. And there are books that you encounter when you're a child that you are less
critical of. Yes,
for sure.
I can haul out a whole bunch of them that I would.
There's some things I probably don't want to re-experience that I loved as a kid.
Right. Exactly. So, no harm, no foul on that. And our kids have read them, we've let them read it because, it's such part of the cultural lexicon that they need to know it.
It's hard enough being a weird homeschooled kid without not partaking of cultural touchstones. In fact, I think we realized that Harry Potter was going to be a way that the kids could, for one, have something in common with other kids in Scouts.
Right. Because it came up in Scouts last year. That's actually, I think, where it came up. It was a year ago when Bella and Sophie were at Scouts and they were talking about their favorite books. And this woman mentioned Harry Potter and Bella and Sophie hadn't read it. And the others were like, you haven't read it yet. And that was because Bella's favorite book at the time was, and still is, I think, Lord of the Rings.
Right. So, there are certain things that, you don't have to know everything about popular culture, but you should have at least a few connecting points where you can, I remember when we were, Bella was, 7 or 8, and we went to the playground, and she was talking with another kid, and the kid kept throwing out, all of his favorite TV shows and movies, and she hadn't seen a single one of them. And at some point, he just kind of looked at her like, "You're weird. You don't know any of them? Not one?"
Our kids have still not seen Frozen. You and I have seen it.
Yes.
But our children have not
actually
seen it.
I don't know that they've seen any. The only Disney princess movie that they've seen is Brave.
No, they saw Moana.
Oh, wait, Moana.
She's technically a Disney princess.
Technically.
She's daughter of royalty.
But they haven't, and I think some of them saw Mulan.
And Bella saw, didn't she see Beauty and the Beast?
Maybe the live action one?
No. I thought she saw the animated one.
No, but they haven't seen Cinderella, Sleeping Beauty, Snow White, Beauty and the Beast, Little Mermaid, Frog...
Tiana.
Frog Prince? Is it Frog Prince? Frog Princess? Princess and the Frog.
I haven't seen that one.
I actually saw that on Disney Plus not too long ago for the first time.
It's all at our fingertips. The only Disney princess they want to see is Princess Leia, Rey, Ahsoka, Sabine.
I feel like at some point they have to have seen these movies just to kind of know what's going on, like culturally, literacy.
There's going to come a point in their teens, and like at some point, Bella is going to be old enough where we can say, you can watch things. Just like, here's your Chromebook. You can stay up. You know, you don't have to go to bed with all the others, and you can watch things.
That's true. In fact, I would like at some point to do a sort of movie TV literacy, like before you launch into the world, here are some of my favorite movies and TV shows that I want to share with you.
And here's some principles on what,
like, and also how to watch things
and how to know what to watch. Because when we were kids, the flood of stuff that's out there. I sit in front of this stupid TV some nights and go, there's so much to choose from. I don't choose any of it. I'm going to go read my book because I'm overwhelmed.
Right. And, you know, I remember one of my roommates in college, like she had grown up on a strict no TV, no movies household. And she kind of went crazy. Like she spent an entire year hardly doing schoolwork, just binge watching everything.
All the TV she couldn't watch at home. Yeah.
Right. And I feel like there's got to be, like, you can't just launch kids into the world with no experience, because then they don't know how to watch. Kind of have to teach them, just though you teach them how to read, you have to teach them how to watch TV and movies critically with some, you know, using their brains.
Right.
Which we've done some of.
Well, I mean, this is kind of what we do at StarQuest. I mean, this is kind of part of our mission, is to help people, you know, explore the intersection of faith and pop culture, but to not be illiterate about the culture, bring our faith with us to the culture.
And, you know, when I was in college, like I had a lot of friends who were movie geeks. So I ended up watching a lot of like cinema, like film,
right?
Not just like blockbusters at the theater, but like these are the
boring
classic
movies.
These are the classic movies that you should have seen. Not boring.
You know, I should get Noelle Crow.
Uh-huh.
She is an old movie buff. And I should get her and a couple other people together to do a old movie club.
That would be
podcast.
Fun.
I mean, there are other ones out there, but like a StarQuest take on that. That would be fun, I think, because she knows her old movies, her classic cinema. So I think that would be kind of fun to get her to see if she'd be interested. I mean, she's a little overwhelmed right now with the American Catholic history that she's already doing, and she runs a Montessori school and all the other stuff that they're doing. So I'm not going to spring it on her now, but I think at some point that would be fun. All right. So,
or maybe at some point we can get, you know, Isabella to like do.
Yeah. Well, what are we talking about? They've been kind of itching to get on this podcast. You know,
I know
one of these days we're going to get them behind this microphone.
We keep
microphone.
Saying that one of these days.
I know. Well, the problem is we record at 9 o'clock on a Sunday night. So they're in bed. So we have to decide, like, this today would have been a perfect day to do it because we didn't have anything else going on today. This afternoon, I could have totally done that night, which I should have. But all right, well, I'm going to write it down after we're done recording, and I'm going to plan for this next week.
All right.
Or during the week. It doesn't have to be on Sunday. Anyway, let's move on.
Okay.
We wanted to talk about this article that I ran across yesterday.
Oh, gosh. You sent this to me yesterday morning. I hadn't even actually got out of bed, and I started, like, firing back messages to you, like, rapid fire, like, indignant.
So this is from Homiletic and Pastoral Review. It's not a scholarly journal. It's a pastoral journal. It's intended for, its primary audience is priests, really, priests and deacons. Okay. It's homilies, homiletic and pastoral review. It's published by Ignatius. Okay. So this article is titled "Homeschooling is Not the Ideal."
I want to start by saying I don't necessarily disagree with the basic thesis of the article, which is to say that if you're trying to kind of like blank slate, what is the most perfect form of education? I'm not convinced that homeschooling is the most perfect blank slate form of education.
Well,
but I'm also not convinced that the parochial school is the most perfect blank slate form of education.
Well, what we've always said is it's not for everyone. Like there is no perfect way that applies to everyone, because every child is an individual. Every family is different, has different needs, and has different situations. So you can't just say this is the best way, this is the ideal way for everyone, because frankly, there are plenty of cultures, societies, and countries where they can't have Catholic schools, where they can't. It's for various reasons.
Well, I mean, the article addresses that. Like, it doesn't say that nobody should ever homeschool, but it kind of says,
But what I wanted
to say.
Okay.
You're jumping in.
Well, you're jumping ahead, but go ahead.
No, I wanted to say, I don't necessarily disagree with the idea that homeschooling is not sort of the pinnacle of education, qua education. So what I have is a lot of nitpicking about the way in which the author goes about making the argument. And
I disagree in that. I think there's a problem at the very principle that they're laying out. I think they are wrong. Let me lay out the article. Okay. I was going to support what I was saying, but go ahead.
Well, you hadn't let me finish
Okay, go ahead.
I think that there is a problem at the heart of the article, which is that it never really addresses pedagogy and educational philosophy. It's kind of skirts around the edges of a lot of the meat of why I homeschool, what I believe about education, and it never really engages the actual argument. It's kind of making a surface argument without digging into the bones of the question.
I find it interesting that it begins with an editorial note from the editors of Homiletic and Pastoral Review. Essays appearing on Homiletic and Pastoral Review have been deemed to be compatible with the teaching of the church, but do not necessarily reflect the opinions of HPR. Father McConey and his staff have always been grateful for the hard work of homeschooling parents and how they extend the kingdom of God into the world through their love and care of God's littlest ones, and then the unwritten bit afterward. So please don't send us nasty grams.
Yeah, they kind of are feeling a need to apologize ahead of time.
When you feel you need to apologize ahead of time, I learned this as a magazine editor. Maybe you shouldn't publish it.
Maybe this wasn't a great choice to publish.
So they start with this fictitious anecdote.
Oh my gosh, this drove me crazy.
So I'll read it because it's not very long. I'll skim it. In the year is 1230 AD, and Countess Theodora, wife of Landulf, Count of Aquino, is about to send her ninth child, her five-year-old son Thomas, to the Benedictine monastery for school, the tradition of her time. Suddenly, and blah, 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 she decides the life and thought of many prominent 21st century American Catholic mothers enters into her soul from the future, and she awakens and thinks, no, the natural path to education is in the home. I am the primary educator. I will educate my little Thomas himself. Sadly, she does, and the mind of the greatest thinker in Catholic history is never fully trained, for Theodora has minimal education herself. Thomas Aquinas, you know, doesn't get his full education, etc., and we the church loses out.
So many problems, so many straw men here.
Right.
For one thing, 20th century moms educating at home have so many advantages that Thomas Aquinas's mom doesn't have. First of all, let's talk about the printing press.
Right. I mean, never mind
the internet.
Yes.
Libraries full of books. And most of us have more than a minimal education.
Right.
So, one, she's setting up this, like, he
and so many
straw man.
Yeah, they. It's a bunch of guys. Right. There are so many homeschool curricula out there. So many resources. The fact is like that. It is a straw man argument because this is not how homeschooling looks.
And it's a sort of apples to oranges. Like, why are we comparing 20th century homeschooling to the education of Thomas Aquinas?
Well, send him to the local parochial school. And Theodore decides, instead of the Benedictine monastery, to send him to the 21st century parochial school that's been magically dropped in her little village, and watch what he gets in that case then. I mean, it's equally a straw man.
Right, because they didn't have parochial schools in his day either. And we're not really talking about homeschooling versus monastic schools, which there are very few of in this day and age.
Right.
I mean, there are some, but by and large, it's just
it's a dumb, they know it's a straw man right off the bat. They call it an introductory novelistic absurdity. They say it's meant to illustrate an important point that seems on the verge of being lost in certain circles of Catholicism today. Although homeschooling moms and dads are at times heroic, here, throw them a bone, homeschooling is not the ideal. There is a higher, better way, the Catholic school. Unlike the homeschool, the Catholic school, when it does what it's supposed to do, provides expertise in teaching, a community that completes the family, role models and authority figures, and a properly formative peer group. So,
oh my gosh,
the first point is there is no such thing as an ideal Catholic school. So they lay out this idea of the ideal Catholic school does this and this and this and this. Yes, that is an ideal, but that doesn't exist because all of them are in one way or another flawed because they're run by regular people. There isn't a perfect anything out there. There isn't a perfect parish. There isn't a perfect chancery. There is not a perfect Catholic school. So you're comparing the perfect ideal, some fictional ideal school, to this flawed model of homeschooling instead of the ideal model of homeschooling. Compare the apples to apples, not an apples to oranges.
And the things that they hold up as the important things about Catholic school also feel like red herrings to me. Expertise of teachers.
Right. They like to point out that the average Catholic school teacher has 15.6 years of teaching experience. No one would argue that either or even both parents could have all of the training and prudence for every subject that veteran teachers possess in one or two subjects.
But again, you're comparing apples to oranges because a lot of teaching expertise is managing a classroom, how to teach a large group of people. And it really doesn't a lot of people who've taught in the classroom recognize that it doesn't actually translate to homeschooling, which is more analogous to.
Right. Ask any Catholic homeschooling parent who is a teacher, which there are plenty of.
Right. So and then expertise also doesn't really question at all the question about pedagogy and training, which is that where are these teachers being trained? By and large, they're getting their training in
secular
universities or
Catholic universities.
Catholic universities, but whose education departments are using secular models. A lot of Catholic homeschoolers have really dug into a philosophy of education. I myself subscribe to a Charlotte Mason philosophy of education, and she was an Anglican teacher who really, really dug into a philosophy of education. She's not Catholic, but she's very compatible with a Catholic tradition of education. And she really digs into starting with first principles. Who is the child? What does an education mean? And I don't feel like a lot of Catholic school teachers have any expertise when you're looking at questioning the theoretical underpinnings of education and trying to come up with what is an authentically Catholic education from the ground up that a lot of homeschoolers have really endeavored to do, which is not to slam Catholic school teachers or Catholic schools themselves. But I think that if you're really going to look at what homeschooling has to offer, a lot of us have to offer an attempt to recapture an authentically Catholic philosophy of education, which I don't think a lot of Catholic schools, some might, but your average parochial school hasn't really done that.
The American Catholic education system, both parochial and secular, bears almost no resemblance to that Benedictine monastic school.
Right.
Like, they didn't sit in classrooms by age all day and read out of textbooks and have tests and exams and quizzes and all of the other stuff, which is assumed to be this is what schooling is. But it's merely just a choice that someone made of this is how we do school.
Right. In fact, I would argue that most homeschoolers are actually providing an education which is much closer to the medieval Benedictine monastic schooling than most Catholic parochial schools. Because when you really dig into the pedagogy and the philosophy of education, as opposed to the expertise of a teacher who's been teaching in a classroom,
whose expertise is based on a certificate they were given by the government.
Right. Like, experience in a classroom doesn't necessarily mean that you have wisdom or experience in forming souls. You could also argue about whether or not Catholic education educators, by and large, are intentional disciples, for example. You know, a lot of Catholic schools that I've looked into have seemed to have lost the understanding that the primary role of Catholic education is forming disciples, and they're really all about the academics, but comparing them to secular academics. So, yeah, I think that that's kind of, again, another straw man.
Right. And then there are other parts of this too. Apart from the model and the experience of the teachers, they talk about, you know, community. They need a community of peers.
Again, this is a straw man because most homeschoolers are not hermits locked away in their homes all day. Most of us belong to communities. We belong to homeschool co-ops, homeschool clubs. Our kids join teams and scouts yeah. and take karate. And we are so involved. In fact, I know homeschoolers who are home less than they're on the road. They're like home, like, hours a day.
A couple hours a day, yeah.
Right. So to say that homeschoolers lack community
is to not
know. I feel like you don't know homeschoolers at all. And again, the community of peers, community of adults? Mentors. It says homeschoolers don't have any mentors except their parents. And I'm thinking my kids look up to their scout leaders, their parish priest, other homeschool parents. They've taken classes with other adults. They have grandparents. They have aunts and uncles. They have family friends. We are not lacking in mentors who are not mom and dad.
Right. It seems like they've got this idea of homeschooling that is very narrow, very stunted, that they're comparing to the wonders of Catholic school.
It feels like it's not really fair because they don't really portray homeschooling for what homeschooling really is. So they're arguing against some idea of homeschooling that's not real.
Yeah, it's problematic up and down.
And I'm kind of disappointed, right, frankly, in Homiletic and Pastoral Review for not having some homeschoolers to talk about the problems with this article or correct, or maybe have a homeschooler read it and dialogue with the authors before publishing it.
And they sort of leave like, well, if you have to, if you don't have a good Catholic school around, I suppose it's, you know, you're allowed. I mean, it's sort of the arguments for NFP, frankly. We don't have to get talking to it for NFP, but sort of the, well, if you have to do NFP, if it's, you know, if you have no other choice, you have to be grave reasons. And it's like, that's not actually what the church teaches. I mean, there's a lot of other practical aspects to this question, too, about Catholic school versus homeschool. For one thing, if you have a big Catholic family, we're talking tens of thousands of dollars a year in tuition. If all five of our kids were going to Catholic schools, we'd be paying thousands and thousands of dollars a year in tuition that we don't have. I mean, then you'd probably have to go get a job, and then we'd have to put kids into daycare, and it would be ridiculous. To do what? To do what we're doing better already at home with our kids?
Right. And I don't want to slam Catholic schools, because I know some people who teach at Catholic schools who are really dedicated educators and who are talented teachers. And I went to Catholic school for 8 years. It is good. But let's face it, Catholic schools, a lot of them have problems, too. And so to sort of hold up the ideal, most perfect Catholic school versus the not realistic homeschool just doesn't feel like it's fair to either one.
Right. I know that the authors are all young, but they're all parents. They're younger than me, so they're young. They have or do currently teach at Catholic schools.
I really feel like if they had really wanted to be intellectually honest, they should have talked to some veteran homeschoolers. I mean, the homeschoolers who have been teaching for 15 years, like the experts who they cite, who have graduated kids into
college.
Now, beyond college, who have kids who have graduated from college and married and started families and are homeschooling their own kids. Like, there are plenty of veteran homeschoolers out there who have seen their kids all the way through college and into life, who have expertise and who could talk about a lot of these questions that the authors don't seem to have tried to find or talk to.
Yeah,
it's kind of embarrassing.
It is kind of embarrassing. So you can tell we feel strongly about this subject. We try not to be like super like we are homeschoolers. We're proud that we're homeschoolers, but we try not to be super like everyone should homeschool. Like, because like I said at the beginning of this, there is no one way. What the way that works is the way that works for you and your children. And for some people, especially if you have a top notch, fantastic private Catholic school, for example, I know some friends who went to their kids went to Trivium. Some of my nieces go to the Montrose School, which is in the Boston suburbs.
Excellent school.
And if we could afford it, that might actually be a great place for Isabella and Sophie. But, you know, we've decided for our family that homeschooling works best for us, and it is our kids are doing very well with it, where they might not do so well if they had done otherwise, if we'd done a different choice in that. So we're not rabid pro homeschoolers in the sense of it's the way everyone should do it. But I just disagree with people who say that it's a lesser way, and that the ideal way is, whether it's Catholic school or public school, there are people who criticize homeschoolers. Good kids should be in the public schools, because then if you take the good kids out, all you have left are the kids who aren't intentional disciples, who aren't beacons of light or whatever. You hear that argument sometimes, which that doesn't hold water for me for a whole other reason. That's a whole nother conversation.
Yeah, that
we'd have to add a half hour to this podcast, which we're not going to do. So,
but I feel like, even if we had a top-notch Catholic school that was like 5 minutes away
and we could afford it,
like take money off the table, take commuting time off the table and all of that, I still might opt for homeschooling just because of the closeness of our kids. That they have a community among themselves, that if they were all separated out into other classrooms, right, into classrooms all day apart from each other, they wouldn't have that, and we wouldn't have the closeness with them either. Like, I like spending my days with them. I like teaching them. If I had the opportunity, there are some classes I would definitely outsource, which
we're kind of doing with the Homeschool Connection.
Right. There are some classes I would outsource more if time and opportunity allowed. But generally, the basic form of education, like spending most of our days together, is definitely something that I would have a hard time giving up, even if I found a really good top-notch school.
And then you lose all those things like the ability to go to museums when there's a great exhibit.
Or take a road trip in September to Kentucky.
11 states.
Right?
Right. Or, you know, and just to do things that you just can't do if you're stuck in someone else's school schedule. So anyway, we can go on and on. We're not going to. Let's wrap things up. I want to take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create Raising the Bets, including Antonio R., Andy F., Michael B., Andrew P., and David H. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue Raising the Bets and all the shows at StarQuest. You can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. So that's it from us. We'd love to hear from you if you have any feedback, anything you want to say about what we've discussed. We've talked about nothing controversial today. Let us know by commenting at sqpn.com/bets. That's BETTS. Or the SQPN Facebook page, facebook.com/StarQuestMedia. Or send an email to bets@sqpn.com. And we'll have links to that article, to the recipe that we talked about before, and to the books we discussed on our show notes at sqpn.com. If you can, we greatly appreciate it, and we've actually had a few. If you could write a review at Apple Podcasts, we would really appreciate it if you could do that. That helps get the show in front of more people, and we helps grow the audience. And, of course, sharing the podcast with your friends. That is the number one way that the podcast grows, and so we really do appreciate when you do that. Until next time, I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Thank you for listening to Raising the Bets on StarQuest.